This is edition number 2015 of The Mardler, recorded in Aylsham on Friday the 1st of May 2026. Hello, you are listening to The Mardler, the weekly talking newspaper for North Norfolk. Today, we bring you the week's news and views from the North Norfolk News of Thursday the 30th of April 2026. My name is Imogen Waterson, and my fellow readers are...
Adrian Allenby,
Merlin Waterson,
and Lorna Wilson.
On the notice board today, please join us in wishing a warm welcome to our new listener, Carol of Munsey. We hope you enjoy listening to The Mardler, Carol. This week, the sun will rise at around 5:15 and will set at about 8:30.
The magazine supplement will follow a little later in the programme and includes TV celebrity Nigel Havers, some background on the Peak District, a visit to Little Walsingham, and librarian Lorna's look at literature, also known as Book Corner.
But we begin with the main news items, which include upset at Cromer Tennis Club, a soggy footpath, unsustainable fuel prices, and parking on pavements. Let's start with those lead stories.
Tennis is seen as a quintessential summer sport, with fans enjoying strawberries at Wimbledon. However, in one Norfolk town, the sport is proving to be divisive, as a club served a surprise to its members. Cromer Tennis Club has announced it wants to axe a concessionary fee for members aged between 31 to 40, claiming that it did not bring in a significant number of people. It has led to fears that people in that age range will give up the sport, leaving the club a cosy enclave for retired members. The decision means members in that age bracket will go from paying £165 for their yearly membership to a staggering £400, the standard adult fee. Kelvin Van Hasselt, the former chairman of the club, has slammed the committee's decision. Mr. Hasselt, who was the chairman between 2019 to 2024, said, "The club, buttressed by its funding from the local council, moves serenely forward as a cosy enclave for the retired. It joins the ranks of so many rural tennis clubs, picking the low-hanging fruit of the retired population, lacking the imagination or perhaps too lazy to make an effort to recruit the 31 to 40-year age group." The decision to axe the fees was announced by the committee in the AGM report, which said, "Major decision on membership by the committee is not to continue with the 31 to 40 age group. It has brought in younger members, but not a significant number. There will be a small increase to all membership prices in line with increased costs." Mr. Hasselt described those between 31 to 40 as the financially disadvantaged generation, as they face costs of mortgages, student loans, and raising a family. As a result, the reduced fees made the sport more accessible for them and helped retain the club's young adult members. He added that those members dismissed as not a significant number may now be lost to the club, and maybe tennis too, perhaps permanently. "It would be a tragedy," he said. The club will continue to provide a concessionary fee for those living more than 20 miles away, including second homeowners, at £210, nearly half what adults in catchment will have to pay. A spokesman for the club said, "We are aware that there are a range of views regarding the proposed changes to membership options. This remains an ongoing discussion and will be reviewed again at our next committee meeting this week. our committee is made up of volunteers elected by the membership, and they are committed to acting in the best interests of the club in all of their decision making. While this process is still underway, it would be premature to comment in detail or draw conclusions. Our focus is on ensuring that all perspectives are considered carefully. A club committee meeting will be held on April the 29th to discuss the concerns.
Two sections of the new King Charles III coastal footpath in Norfolk need to be changed, so walkers do not find themselves walking through a waterlogged field. The 2,700-mile route around England has been more than a decade in the making, with much of its route around Norfolk created by improved parts of existing national trails, such as the Norfolk Coast Path. But Natural England is having to seek permission from the government to make changes to the approved route near Titchwell on the stretch between Weybourne and Hunstanton. Officials said, "It has become apparent that a part of the route along a field edge directly north of St Mary's Church in Titchwell is likely to become waterlogged, particularly during winter months." Natural England and Norfolk County Council have now identified a varied route which the landowner has agreed to that is a shorter, more direct route, avoiding the edge of the field that tends to become wet in winter. A second change has been requested on a section of the route close to the Briarfields Hotel off the A149 near Titchwell because of a change in land ownership. Natural England officials said, "Land ownership has changed and part of the route along the track adjacent to the Briarfields Hotel now has approved planning permission for a built extension." Following consultation with the landowner and Norfolk County Council, Natural England now proposes a varied route around the planned extension. Natural England believes that moving the trail away from the existing alignment alongside the road and track onto the grounds of Briarfields Hotel presents an opportunity for a more pleasant walking experience in a meadow along a mown grass path already used by hotel visitors. This route also means that walkers will be away from road traffic along Main Road for a longer distance. Making the two changes would cost £4,000, Natural England officials said. The decision on whether to make the changes rests with Environment Secretary Emma Reynolds. The King Charles III Coast Path will be the longest managed coastal walking route in the world when complete. But eyebrows were previously raised at part of the route through West Norfolk because a stretch takes hikers through a King's Lynn industrial estate.
The boss of a Norfolk transport company has said rising fuel prices are not sustainable after his firm saw its monthly bill rise by £60,000 since the start of the war in the Middle East. Charles Sanders, who owns Sanders Coaches, said, "The conflict has impacted both its bus and coach services." The Holt-based firm is well known for providing matchday coaches for Norwich City supporters travelling to home and away games. Mr. Sanders said it cost the company £110 more in fuel per coach to take fans to Bristol on Saturday, April the 18th, than it would have done before the conflict. "Our bill last month was about £60,000 dearer than previous to the war, so it's a huge amount of money," he told BBC Radio Norfolk. "We're contemplating what we're going to do if this carries on much longer. In the short term, the company can weather some of these things, but if this is going to go on all summer, then we're going to have to do something because we want to be in business at the end of the summer." Petrol and diesel prices have risen sharply since the outbreak of the US-Israel war with Iran 7 weeks ago due to the effective closure of the Straits of Hormuz. The narrow waterway normally carries about a fifth of the world's oil. Mr. Sanders said the bus company had seen a small increase in passengers because more people are using public transport instead of their cars to avoid paying fuel. However, he said the firm had been unable to raise its bus fares to cover some of the extra fuel cost because of the government's £3 cap on bus fares. You can't be forced to provide a service at a loss just because the government has put something in place, he said. The government say they're not going to do anything about that and that they might have a review in the autumn. Well, that's not going to help businesses very much.
Special patrols could target drivers outside Norfolk schools when new powers allowing enforcement officers to fine motorists who park on pavements come into force. Norfolk County Council is due to gain new and improved legal powers from the government, potentially later this year, which will enable it to punish drivers who obstruct pavements. County Hall leaders confirmed in March that they were keen to make use of the new powers when they become available. And they have revealed that, when they do get those powers, they could tailor patrols to focus on drivers who put the safety of children at risk by mounting pavements near schools. The long-standing issue of dangerous parking near schools and whether the new powers could help combat that was raised at a recent meeting of the council's Conservative-controlled cabinet. Liberal Democrat councillor Rob Colwell and Green councillor Ben Price both raised concerns about pavement parking outside schools and called for the new powers to be used to tackle the problem. Graham Plant, Conservative Cabinet Member for Highways, Infrastructure and Transport, said the authority was waiting for the necessary legislation to be put in place and for councils to be given guidance over the new powers. But he said, once we receive the statutory guidance, we will decide how best and practically apply this in Norfolk, in discussion with our Parking Partner Authority colleagues. If an area is highlighted as a particular problem, then civil enforcement officer patrols could be tailored to include that area, with appropriate enforcement applied in accordance with the new guidelines. The level of fines which enforcement officers would be able to impose has yet to be confirmed, but in London, where they already have that power, drivers can be fined up to £130, whilst in Scotland fines are £100. Motoring organisation the RAC has backed the new powers, but stressed councils like Norfolk need to treat drivers fairly.
A man is to stand trial accused of strangling his daughter. Gareth Cooper, 45, was charged with intentional strangulation and assault by beating in relation to an incident involving his daughter in North Walsham on August the 8th last year. Cooper, of the street Corpusty near Holt, appeared at Norwich Crown Court when he denied both offences. He will stand trial on May the 22nd, 2028.
A man is due to appear in court this month following a stabbing in a North Norfolk coastal town. Ryan Palmer has been charged with causing grievous bodily harm, GBH, with intent and possession of a knife in a public place. The 32-year-old is due to appear at Norwich Crown Court on May the 11th. His court appearance comes after police were called to Rowton Road, Cromer, at 9:15pm on April the 11th, following reports a man had been stabbed. The victim, a man in his 30s, suffered a stab wound to the abdomen and was taken to the Norfolk and Norwich Hospital. Palmer of Browns Hill, Cromer, was subsequently arrested and charged. He first appeared at Great Yarmouth Magistrates Court last month. He was remanded in custody until next court appearance.
People are urged to be vigilant after a rogue trader in a Nissan pickup targeted homes in Norfolk. Norfolk County Council received reports of a man offering immediate repairs for supposed roof damage he had spotted on the roofs of properties in Stalham. He specifically told homeowners he could see missing tiles. The man was seen using a grey Nissan Navara pickup with signage indicating his trade. The council advises that people should never deal with cold callers. This includes never allowing them on the private property, never agreeing to further visits, and never providing personal information or agreeing to new contracts, regardless of any claims or special offers presented. People are reminded to report any sighting of doorstep cold callers in Norfolk. They can do this through the Citizens Advice Consumer Helpline on free phone 0808 223 1133 or Norfolk Constabulary via 101.
Two motorcycles have been stolen from a museum in North Norfolk. The theft is believed to have happened at the Norfolk Motorcycle Museum in North Walsham in the early hours of Saturday, April the 18th. Police are now hunting for suspects in the case. A spokesman for Norfolk Constabulary said, "We were called at 11:28 a.m. on Saturday to a premises on Norwich Road, North Walsham, following reports two motorcycles had been stolen. An investigation is underway."
Our next few news items include planning issues in Catfield, Sharrington, Blakeney and Holt, as well as road closures, a barn demolition, a housing scheme and Padel Courts.
A fresh bid for bungalows has reopened old wounds in a Broads village. In Catfield, near Stalham, developers want to build up to 10 single-storey homes in a field off Lee Road. But neighbours have spoken of stress and anguish. The parish council has branded the sewage system criminally inadequate, and officials are investigating claims of illegal tree felling. The scheme is facing 8 formal objections from locals and authorities, with concerns focused on flooding, traffic, wildlife loss, and the future of the road's retirement community. The application, now under revised plans, is being considered by North Norfolk District Council, NNDC. It follows a previously withdrawn bid for 18 houses, which had faced similar opposition from the community. One resident complained of 20 years of disruption to the residents in Lee Road, with planning proposals going in and being rejected on and off. Just when you think it is cancelled, it starts again. This causes severe stress and anguish to us all. Planning proposals need to stop completely to give us all peace, they added. Several objectors questioned the need for more housing in an area where two bungalows have reportedly sat empty for years. Catfield Parish Council has lodged a detailed objection, citing the site's proximity to internationally protected wetlands. It argues that development could pose an unacceptable environmental risk to the region's delicate ecosystems, including areas designated as Sites of Special Scientific Interest, SSSI, and Special Protection Areas, SPA, connected to the Norfolk Broads. The Parish Council also highlighted long-standing problems with the village's ageing sewage system. Residents of Lee Road, into whose main drains the proposed development would feed, are regularly troubled by incidents attributable to the inability of the current sewers to cope, even with current demand, it said. It referred to untreated sewage spills into local rivers, including the Ant, and said, "This is pollution of industrial proportions and akin to criminal behaviour." The lead local flood authority has also formally objected to the application, saying it lacks sufficient evidence on how surface water will be safely managed. It warned that the plans fail to comply with the National Planning Policy Framework and other relevant guidelines. The Forestry Commission is investigating whether tree felling on the site was carried out illegally. It has said this could result in a restocking notice requiring trees to be replanted and maintained for 10 years. A planning statement submitted with the latest application claims the scheme is more sensitive, sustainable, and community-focused. It argues that the development will bring a significant number of benefits to the parish and wider district. The statement says each bungalow would include a generous garden, with the overall layout designed to ensure privacy for existing and future residents. In total, 27 parking spaces are proposed. The scheme has been described as consistent with neighbouring properties, but objections continue to mount. The application will be discussed by the Council's Planning Committee. Residents can view or comment on the application by searching reference PO/26/0036 on the NNDC planning portal.
A shepherd's hut in a back garden could become a holiday let with rules to prevent visitors from disturbing the neighbours. Ben Rivett has applied to change the use of the wooden structure behind his house at Sharrington near Holt. It was installed in November 2023 and since then has been used as an office and to accommodate family members for overnight stays. Mr. Rivett said, "Hut rules have been drawn up to ensure minimal impact if the one-bedroom let is given the go-ahead. They stipulate no amplified music, including speakers or drums, and no parties, fires or disposable barbecues." Mr. Rivett adds he would have zero tolerance to antisocial behaviour and guests would not be allowed to use fireworks, sky lanterns or balloons during their stay. Those who bring dogs with them, which bark excessively, will be asked to leave. He adds, "We have researched the demographic and type of guests that we would expect. This, we understand, would include bird watchers, couples, or single person visiting the area, so consider it is unlikely to attract unwanted guests." Whilst there is a neighbour to the north, the hut is screened by hedges and its entrance faces away from next door. Mr. Rivett said he decided to rent out the hut because it is well positioned for nearby attractions, including Holt, Blakeney, Thurstead Steam Museum and Christmas Spectacular, and the Gerrals at Leatherhead. The hut has water and electricity installed, while the site also includes parking, with guests only expected to bring one car. While the oak building is situated in a conservation area, the garden around it has been landscaped with trees and it cannot be seen from Brinton Road, which runs past the site. A decision is expected from North Norfolk Council later this year.
A man has won his planning row against a council after he demolished his home to rebuild a larger one in a Norfolk village. Mr. Ingham was in dispute with North Norfolk District Council after his proposal to replace the old police house at Blakeney near Holt with a new two-storey property was refused. He said the council had previously approved plans for a very similar development, during which parts of the building on Langham Road were taken down before some minor changes were made. However, Officers had argued that this had gone beyond the scope of the permission and was tantamount to demolition and replacement. Mr. Ingham then submitted a planning application to regularise the situation, but this was later refused. Councillors decided that the proposal would result in a larger house which would have a significantly detrimental, overbearing impact on people living next door. It was also said that it would result in a significantly detrimental loss of daylight and sunlight and unacceptable noise impacts on nearby neighbours due to proposed air conditioning units. So, Mr. Ingham appealed his case to the Planning Inspectorate, which is a government body which rules over planning disputes. He said in an appeal statement, "The differences between the approved scheme and what was proposed are very minor, and we strongly disagree with the conclusions of the Planning Committee." Neighbours had objected to the scheme with concerns that the development was significantly more massive than the original property. One said the ridgeline was higher than that on the agreed plans and had caused a loss of sunlight to their property, which was now also overlooked by security cameras. But the inspector has allowed the application, claiming it would not have a harmful effect on the character and appearance of the area or have a harmful effect on living conditions for neighbours.
It is often deemed Norfolk's poshest town, with its Georgian architecture and independent shops. But there is one feature locals say is missing. Young people living in Holt are currently facing a 12-mile round trip to use the nearest skate park, making it inaccessible for some keen skaters and bikers in the town. For several years, young people and adult skate park users have called for a facility to be built nearby to make the sport easier for all to enjoy. And, in an effort to make this happen, a campaign group called Holt Owl Skate Park has explained the importance of skate parks in communities like theirs. It's time away from screens and game consoles and is proven to help children grow in self-esteem and confidence, a spokeswoman for the group said. She added that it is particularly crucial after studies following the COVID lockdown have shown that many children had mental health issues after missing out on social interaction with their friends. The group has secured a 30-year lease on land at Holt Sports Centre Field to build the skate park and is hoping to fundraise £250,000 for the project through a wide range of events. Connor Rouse, District Councillor, has taken part in the ambitious fundraising efforts through multiple activities, such as dyeing his hair blue, walking 100,000 steps, and running the Manchester Marathon. "I couldn't have done it without the diligent work of the skate park committee," he said. "Seeing their hard work has inspired me to do the same and give it my all." The proposed skate park would be free to use and accessible by foot, with no fuel costs, emissions, or club fees. The facility is designed to be inclusive, supporting users of scooters, skateboards, BMX bikes and inline skates. It also aims to be accessible to wheelchair users who can use adapted boards attached to their wheelchairs. Fundraising efforts are ongoing.
A £90,000 project will close a stretch of an A road. The work will take place on the A1151 Norwich Road between School Road and Yarmouth Road in Ashmanor, Barton Turf and Smallborough near Wroxham. Overnight closures are scheduled while the work is in progress, running from 7pm to 5am. These will happen on May the 7th and May the 20th for the removal of road studs and surface dressing, followed by another closure on June the 5th for lining and road stud replacement. Access to properties within the closure will be maintained at all times, and a fully signed diversion route will be in operation for the duration. The scheme will be carried out by Norfolk County Council's Infrastructure Department and its contractor, Keir Highway Services. All dates listed are weather dependent. A Norfolk County Council spokeswoman said, "The County Council thanks people for their patience while this essential road maintenance work is carried out."
A bid to demolish disused barns to make way for new homes on a Norfolk farm has been given the go-ahead. North Norfolk District Council has approved plans to tear down agricultural buildings at a farm off Back Road in East Ruston and build four new houses. The proposal, which was submitted by Charles Bracey 2 years ago, includes three new single-storey properties and one that was a storey and a half. In a statement, it said that the new homes were designed to have the form and appearance of traditional rural agricultural buildings. The existing buildings on the site were previously used as storage or to house pigs, but both of these uses have since become redundant, the plans added. Mr. Brace's bid had sparked concerns in the community over whether the roads were suitable for the extra traffic as well as the lack of public transport. One comment said, "The road which the site exists on is no more than a single-track lane with many potholes and irregularities, and any additional traffic would damage the road further." However, the council has noted that the Highways Authority did not object to the application and approved the plans.
Councillors have criticised plans to build new homes in a Norfolk village because the occupants will have to rely on cars. They raised concerns over proposals for the two properties in Tuttington because there is not enough public transport to the village, which is around 2 miles from Aylsham. Eleanor Laming, a Green councillor and vice chairman of the Broadland District Council Planning Committee, said, "I have no doubt nearly all journeys from this development will be made by car. I don't consider it to be a sustainable development." The plans, which were first submitted in 2024, involve building two homes on land in Aylsham Road. Tory councillor Peter Berry said he had doubts over whether it is a sustainable location for new homes. Peter Orber, Liberal Democrat councillor for Drayton South, added, "Sustainability is in question here for sure." Despite the criticism, Ms. Laming said she was backing the scheme due to the council not having a 5-year housing land supply. Councils have to demonstrate they have enough land for at least 5 years' worth of housing. Without being able to show this, it makes it harder for them to reject schemes put forward by developers. The committee unanimously backed the plans.
New paddle tennis courts are set to open after a Norfolk club was given the green light to expand. Cromer Tennis and Racket Club has been given the go-ahead to build two new courts at its site off Norwich Road in Cromer. The club had submitted the proposal to North Norfolk District Council last year to enhance its current facilities and embrace one of the UK's fastest growing sports. By embracing new trends in sport and investing in modern multifunctional infrastructure, Cromer Tennis and Racket Club aims to remain a vibrant, inclusive and future-facing sports facility, a planning statement said. The proposal included canopies over the courts to make sure they could be used all year round, regardless of the weather. The statement added, "This promotes consistent community use and supports physical activity in all seasons." The council approved the plans and noted that it would not be overbearing on any neighbouring properties. The club site was founded in 1907 and currently comprises 10 grass courts, 4 all-weather floodlit courts, 2 squash courts, 2 table tennis tables and 4 outdoor pickleball courts. You are listening to edition number 2015 of The Mardler, recorded on Friday, the 1st of May, 2026. Still to come, there are items about treasure, trees and treats, and, of course, the Mardler magazine supplement. But before all of that, a letter to the editor of the North Norfolk News.
Mary Russell from Carer's Voice writes, "Carers from our Carer's Cafe at Cromer Hospital had the opportunity of enjoying free refreshments, well-being and relaxation sessions and yummy refreshments thanks to the organisations, staff and volunteers brought together by Carer's Voice in Cromer. Our town crier added to the fun and the chance to share information and experiences while we gained future opportunities to work together. One thing that stood out for me was the real desire to reach out, support and encourage our folk who are looking after others, many who do not see themselves as carers. In thanks to all who attended, I would ask our community to consider sharing their experiences and ideas on caring so their voice can be heard and services and decisions taken with people in mind. Carers Cafe is open to anyone interested in care and fun. There is an informal opportunity to chat and share information while having a wee cuppa and yummy cakes, free. First Wednesday month, 10 to 12, we had a super visit to the Christmas show at the pier. Carers Voice is always keen to hear from you. Their contact is info@carersvoice.org or call 0793 209 5260.
Next, we have just one obituary. Amy Margaret Russell passed away peacefully on Sunday, April 19th at Cranmer House, aged 94 years. Her much-loved wife to Graham, deceased, mother of Andrew, and loving grandparent to Leighton and Erin, and great-grandmother to Brodie and Dylan. Amy's funeral service will take place at Cromer Crematorium at 11:30 a.m. on Thursday, May the 14th. Family flowers only, please, but donations are welcomed in Amy's memory for the Blakeney 12 and may be left via her tribute page at amyrussell.muchloved.com.
And now some local events, starting with an invitation from the Northern Ballet Company.
Northern Ballet's production of Gentleman Jack tours to Norwich Theatre Royal from Wednesday the 27th of May to Saturday the 30th of May, 2026. There will be an audio-described performance of Gentleman Jack on Saturday the 30th of May at 2:30 p.m, with pre-show notes starting at 2:15 p.m. A free touch tour insight talk will take place at 12:15 to 1:30 p.m. on the same day. 2026 will see Northern Ballet bring to the stage the extraordinary story of Ann Lister, better known as Gentleman Jack. A powerful Yorkshire woman, and stood out from the crowd even in her time. But it was only after her death, when her secret diaries were decoded, that a truly exceptional life was uncovered. Ann lived, dressed, and loved as she desired, not as society expected her to. Tickets for the audio-described performance are priced from £40 per person, and a free companion ticket is available. To book tickets or for more information, please call the theatre's box office on 01603 630 000. Please make sure to specify that you are booking for an audio-described performance and let the access line operator know if you have any access needs. To book your free place on the Touch Tour Insight, please let the operator know that you wish to attend. The live audio description will be delivered by ex-premier dancer Pippa Moore MBE and a specialist vocalized practitioner, bringing the performance to life in your mind's eye with vivid descriptions of the movement, action, and drama that takes place on stage. At our free Touch Tour Insight Talk, you will gain a deeper understanding of Gentleman Jack as you hear descriptions of the scenery, with the opportunity to see and feel some of the costumes. The pre-show notes will take place in the auditorium through your headset or device 15 minutes before the performance begins. The notes offer a detailed description of the set, costumes, story, and characters from Gentleman Jack. For more information about Northern Ballet's productions and audio-described performances, please contact the Northern Ballet Learning Team email, learning@northernballet.com. We look forward to welcoming you and hope that you enjoy the show.
On Sunday, the 3rd of May, there is a great day out for transport enthusiasts, family, and anyone who loves nostalgia. The Classics and Steam event starts at 10 a.m. and costs £25. It is located at the Bure Valley Railway, Aylsham Station, Norwich Road, Aylsham. Contact 01263 733 858. On Bank Holiday Monday, the 4th of May, there is the Overstrand Together Fun Dog Show, running from 1 p.m. to 5 p.m. at the Sea Marge Hotel in Overstrand. Visit the gardens, enjoy the refreshments, and see who has the waggiest tail. Contact 07890 541 846. On Thursday, the 7th of May, there is a talk by Jack Perks on freshwater fish and pond river wildlife, starting at 1 p.m. with a cost of £15.31 and located at the Norfolk Wildlife Trust, Cly, and Salthouse Marshes Visitor Centre, Coast Road, Cly next the sea. Contact 01603 625 540. And finally, on Monday the 8th of May, there is a charity coffee morning in Honing, running from 10 a.m. till noon and located at the Village Hall, the street Honing. Tea, coffee, bacon rolls and cakes will be on offer, with proceeds going to the Colney Centre, NNUH. We turn now to this week's Mardler magazine supplement, where we hear what TV star Nigel Havers is up to, learn a little bit about the Peak District National Park, discover a gem of the Norfolk Tourist Trail, and find out what Lorna the Librarian has been reading.
Start with an article published in the Wroxham and Coltishall Book of April 2026, where we catch up with Nigel Havers, who has plenty of stories to tell about his five decades in showbiz. Nigel Havers' career could have taken a very different course if he'd followed in the footsteps of his father and grandfather, both prominent lawyers. The son of late Lord Chancellor Michael Havers, he had a high society background. However, last spring, Nigel starred as his grandfather in the ITV historical drama A Cruel Love, the Ruth Ellis story, about the last woman to be hanged in the UK. In it, he portrayed High Court Judge Sir Cecil Havers, who sentenced the 28-year-old London nightclub hostess to death in 1955 for murdering her lover. Nigel, now 74, recalled filming the series as an emotional experience, bursting into tears afterwards. I felt very sorry for my grandfather because he was extremely upset. He wrote a letter to the Home Secretary at the time and said this woman must not be hanged, and the Home Secretary ignored it. Intrigued by his family, Nigel explored his roots on the BBC's Who Do You Think You Are?, discovering more about his ancestors and reflecting on his privileged, if somewhat emotionally distant, upbringing. He went to boarding school in Suffolk at the age of 6, which he has admitted he found challenging. However, it was there that he discovered his passion for acting, going on to the arts educational schools in London. Nigel has a varied CV. While he has appeared in panto and TV soaps such as Coronation Street and Benidorm, he is well known for period dramas, including ITV's Downton Abbey, and films like Chariots of Fire, Empire of the Sun, and A Passage to India. He has also had a successful stage career, appearing in productions such as Art, The Importance of Being Earnest, and Private Lives. As host of BBC daytime show The Bidding Room since it first aired in 2020, he welcomes sellers who come face to face with 5 dealers who in turn battle it out to make the highest bid. Series 8 is confirmed for 2026. Away from work, Nigel lives a quiet life with his third wife, Georgiana Bronfman, and their pet dog Charlie, with homes in Chelsea and Wiltshire. He had a daughter with his first wife, Carolyn, and was happily married to his second, former model and actor Polly Williams, for 15 years before her death in 2004. Nigel and Georgiana married in 2007. And Nigel has previously opened up about how lucky he felt to find love again, having met his wife at a reception. Speaking on the White Wine Question Time podcast, he told former Loose Women anchor Kate Thornton, "We are very good at being together and on our own. We don't need to go to see anybody else, really." Another passion is horse racing. "I don't gamble unless I actually go to the races, so I'll just do an imaginary bet and I'll normally win," he revealed in an interview ahead of his first ever live show last March. Such was the tour's sellout success that Nigel is back with it this spring and then in the autumn, taking audiences on a thoroughly entertaining trot through his long career. Nigel says, "Of course, there'll be behind-the-scenes gossip, tales of triumph and disaster, moments of sheer madness and a fair bit of talking rubbish. And just when you think you've got me figured out, I might surprise you." For venues and to book tickets for Nigel Havers on tour, visit the website nigelhavers.live.
For our next article, we turn to a BBC News website article published on the 19th of April 2026, in which Caroline Lowbridge writes about ruled names, railways, and a mass trespass. The Peak District became the UK's first national park 75 years ago, but the area has been attracting visitors for much longer. One of the oldest tourist attractions is the Devil's Arse, one of 4 caves in Castledown that are accessible to the public. "It makes a huge farting noise, basically," says John Harrison, director of the site, as he explains where its name originates. It was always known as the Devil's Arse, and then in Victorian times, with their sort of prudish outlook on life, it became offensive. They changed it to the Devil's Hole, and then Peak's Hole, and then Peak Cavern. When we took it on, it was Peak Cavern, and we changed it back to the Devil's Arse. When the cave floods, the rising and falling of the water sucks through air and makes a sound uncannily similar to flatulence. It can flood two or three times a year, but it's happening more often at the moment, so it's being heard more regularly, says John. The Devil's Arse was named as one of the Seven Wonders of the Peak back in 1636 in a book by philosopher Thomas Hobbes, which shows people have been visiting the cave and the wider Peak District for centuries. In the 19th century, railway companies started to promote the idea of visiting the Peak District for leisure, but people could not access as much of the area as they can today. This was because much of it was privately owned, and many landowners did not want people rambling through. Tensions were highlighted in 1932 by the mass trespass of Kinder Scout, moorland kept exclusively for grouse shooting by its owner, the Duke of Devonshire. Organised by the British Workers' Sports Federation, hundreds of people took part, and five were imprisoned after being charged with unlawful assembly and breach of the peace. The National Parks and Access to the Countryside Act was introduced in 1949, and this led to the creation of national parks. The first was the Peak District on 17th of April 1951. However, people did not suddenly have the right to roam wherever they liked. The 1949 Act didn't actually open up any land, says Kate Conto, Policy and Public Affairs Manager at the Ramblers. It gave a mechanism for the national parks to try and get agreement with landowners to open up land. The National Trust has been key in opening up much of the Peak District to the public. It is now the biggest landowner in the national park and looks after sites including Mam Tor, Kinder Scout, Dovedale, Thorpe Cloud and Winnett's Pass. Among the charity's site is the Longshore Estate, which was once threatened with development but saved by the campaigner Ethel Haythornwaite. Ethel was widowed at the age of 23 when her husband was killed in combat during World War I. The story goes that Ethel's family encouraged her to take restorative walks, and she became passionate about the countryside. She founded a group that later became the Peak District and South Yorkshire branch of the Campaign to Protect Rural England, CPRE, which helped raise funds to buy the Longshore Estate. It was gifted to the National Trust in 1931. Ethel was instrumental in securing Longshore for the nation, says Craig Best, General Manager for the National Trust in the Peak District. Ethel was also part of the campaign to establish the Peak District as a national park, and a hill-walking challenge called the Ethels was created in her honour in 2021. Transport has also been highlighted as an issue in recent years. Many of the railway lines that once brought visitors to the Peak District are long since closed, and some are now walking trails. But people who live in the Peak District say cars are causing chaos, particularly in areas like Castleton, which has attracted a growing number of visitors in recent years. Now, as part of the 75th anniversary celebrations, the Peak District National Park Authority has launched a tube-style map to promote the use of public transport. But Craig believes the 75th anniversary of the National Park, which now welcomes about 13 million visitors a year, is something to be celebrated.
Next, we hear about a quirky, if slightly spooky, historic village in the hidden heart of Norfolk. This article was published on the Norfolk Writer website on the 5th of June, 2024. You can read 100 guidebooks to Norfolk and still get the impression that Walsingham is a bit of an add-on. But you will do well to find anywhere else quite like it. It is one of Norfolk's few absolute must-visits. Not to be confused with nearby Great Walsingham, which is considerably littler than Little Walsingham, Little Walsingham remains a major pilgrimage site for a host of different religions and denominations therein. Whatever your views on all matters holy, it is worth visiting Little Walsingham, if only to take in its architecture and history. Every corner of the village offers something of note, be it rows of lopsided angular houses or stern Victorian correction centres. The village is yet to be gentrified and exudes a stately confidence in its strangeness. The grocery shop, with its Hovis Best of Both, Lotto scratch cards and Happy Shopper tins of new potatoes, is older than most buildings in America. Walsingham's fame came as a result of a local woman, Richeldis de Favaches, claiming she was visited multiple times by the Virgin Mary in 1061. On one of her visits, Mary presented Richeldis with a vision of her home in Nazareth. Richeldis took down measurements and set about having it rebuilt in Walsingham as a shrine. After a few teething problems with the project, Richeldis awoke one evening to find the shrine being built in a different location to the original plot. Not only that, but angels were now doing the construction work, not local builders. Goodness knows what their night rates were. The discovery of a natural spring below the shrine was a surefire signifier of God's hand, and soon people were making the pilgrimage to Walsingham, arriving from overseas by boat in nearby coastal towns such as Wells and Blakeney to be cured by the water. They walked the last mile barefoot, taking their shoes off at the Slipper Chapel on the edge of the village. There is some doubt about the correct dating of the shrine. Some historians have argued that Richeldis de Favaches lived a century later, late enough for her son to join the Crusades, which records suggest he did. One suspects these finer details don't quite matter, that the shrine may have been built in 1140 and not 1061 is unlikely to deter Catholics or provide much ammunition for atheists. Walsingham doesn't deal in such irrelevances. The actual site of the shrine is equally clouded in uncertainty, despite a stone in the ruined priory grounds alleging to mark the spot. The original well to the spring is also lost to time. But a 1930s Anglican shrine, which today stands above an old Saxon well, may well be it. Nobody knows. As the centuries passed, and the waters healed ever-increasing numbers of weary pilgrims, the village became known as England's Nazareth. Many referred to stars in the Milky Way as the Walsingham Way. Even the celestial bodies appeared to guide lowly souls to its waters. I should warn you that while some people adore Little Walsingham's kookiness, others hate it. It was ever thus. Henry VIII was unusual in that he flitted between the two emotions. A regular pilgrim in his early years, Henry later adopted a more curmudgeonly attitude to all things Catholic. The Slipper Chapel, where once he'd removed his footwear, soon became a cowshed. The spectacular ruined abbey in the centre of the village was the more visible outcome of his kingly change of humour. I find it endearing to see somewhere demonstrate its faith so boldly. What other places do so? It is one of the few villages where you can still see nuns pottering around in their habits, head down, being actual nuns. I can almost guarantee that when you go, you'll be one of only about four other visitors. Unless, of course, you visit bang in the middle of a pilgrimage weekend, in which case you might think you've accidentally wandered down into Oxford Circus tube station at rush hour. Check the calendar beforehand. Walsingham's other major annual rush is when the snowdrops blossom in mid-February and the village is overrun by people in North Face jackets. They are quite some sight. The flowers, not the jackets. Love it or hate it, or wildly indifferent, you'll never forget going to Little Walsingham. It's strange like that.
Each one of us has our own eclectic taste in books, and so this month's Book Corner is a Mad May miscellany chosen from across the genre. We hoped to tempt you with at least one of the following books. Let's begin by taking a leap into the future with Ian M. Banks. In Against a Dark Background, we meet Lady Sharrow. Once the fearless leader of a combat team, she is now being hunted by the Hoos, a religious cult which is determined to assassinate her. Lady Sharrow's only hope of escape is to find the last of the incredibly powerful Lazy Guns before the Hoos track her down. We follow her epic journey through phenomenal landscapes of the Galtarian system, meeting colourful characters along the way. The story switches from past to present, one explaining the other. This is exceptional storytelling. Combined with breathtaking imagination, it is an absorbing and compelling read. Perhaps you would prefer to step back in time with The Miniaturist by Jessie Burton. This beautifully atmospheric historical novel has recently been serialised on television. It's autumn in 1686. 18-year-old Nella knocks at the door of a grand house in the wealthiest quarter of Amsterdam. She has come from the country to begin a new life as the wife of illustrious merchant trader Johannes Brandt. Central to the story is his extraordinary wedding gift to her. This cabinet-sized replica of their home is to be furnished by an elusive miniaturist whose tiny creations mirror their real-life counterparts in unexpected ways. At first, Nella is mystified by the closed world of the Brandt household, but as she uncovers its secrets, she realises the escalating dangers that await them all. This is a story of love, obsession, betrayal and retribution, filled with heart-pounding suspense. Next, we head off for an adventure in The Greatest Enemy by Douglas Rieman. Set in 1970, we join Lieutenant Commander Standish aboard HMS Terrapin. Once part of a crack hunter-killer group, she is now working out her last commission in the Gulf of Thailand. A new captain is given charge of the languishing ship and its rather relaxed crew. A new captain who is completely old school, bubbling with aggressive patriotism and alive with no-nonsense enthusiasm. Under his stubborn leadership, Standish and his fellow crewmates discover a long-forgotten unity of purpose as they patrol an area of sea infested with pirate junks and smugglers. This is a good naval story with great action scenes, officer politics and an engaging plot. The final action is riveting. And for our final book choice, we ask you to put on your thinking caps and work out who done it. Death of a Gossip is the very first book in the Hamish Macbeth crime series from best-selling author M.C. Beaton. We visit the Highlands of Scotland and follow the laid-back village constable who is investigating the murder of Lady Jane Winters. Lady Jane, a malicious gossip columnist, has been strangled and drowned whilst attending a fly fishing school. With the remaining guests as prime suspects, Hamish steers a course through the choppy waters of Lady Jane's life to find the murderer. Like all good murder mysteries, there are many leads to follow, and Hamish is well aware that uncovering secrets is dangerous work. With its beautiful descriptions of Scotland's scenery, this is an atmospheric, amusing introduction to Hamish's unique approach to policing and his quiet, sharp-witted personality. If you would like to read some of these books, you can borrow or request all of them from your favourite audio library, such as Calibre, the RNIB Library, or Norfolk County Libraries. You can even listen to them on the internet or an Alexa smart speaker. Whatever you choose to read this month, we do hope you enjoy it.
And those items conclude this week's magazine supplement. Our thanks go to the authors of these articles for their contributions.
Returning to the news, our penultimate selection of articles include a medieval gold coin find, educational ash tree planting, a galaxy of starfish, and the plight of butterflies.
A remarkable hoard of rare early medieval gold coins, some from the Byzantine Empire, have been discovered in Norfolk farmland. They were found during a series of organised metal detecting rallies on a series of fields near Colby. At a hearing at Norfolk Coroner's Court, Johanna Thompson, the area coroner, declared the items treasure. The finds were described as a significant early medieval hoard and include coins linked to the Merovingian kingdom, the Byzantine Empire, and early continental Europe. The treasure hearing first opened on March the 26th, 2026, but was adjourned until April 22 to allow further documentation to be gathered. At the resumed hearing, the court was told 13 had been found between January the 23rd and October the 9th, 2022. During a series of organised metal detecting rallies, at the resumed hearing, the court was told 13 had been found between January the 23rd and October the 9th, 2022, during a series of organised metal detecting rallies on fields belonging to the same farm. A further coin was later discovered on March the 31st, 2024. All of the coins were found by different people taking part in the rallies. One of the finders, Mr. Stedman, was present in court for the hearing. A report prepared by experts at the British Museum set out the age, origin, and composition of the coins while an image of the finds was displayed. The report concluded the coins dated from in or after AD 530 and fell within the early medieval period. Experts identified the hoard as containing two Byzantine solidi, two pseudo-imperial Merovingian solidi, 9 Merovingian tremises and 1 irregular gold solidus. The Merovingian dynasty ruled large parts of what is now France and neighbouring regions between the 5th and 8th centuries, while Byzantine coins originated from the Eastern Roman Empire centred on Constantinople. The presence of such coins in Norfolk offers a glimpse into long-distance trade, wealth, and movement of precious objects during the so-called Dark Ages. Treasure hearings are held to determine whether objects meet the legal definition of treasure under the Treasure Act. In broad terms, items at least 300 years old, containing a significant proportion of precious metal, can qualify. The court heard the coins met the criteria because two or more coins from the same find contained at least 10% precious metal. The ruling means museums will now have the opportunity to express an interest in acquiring the hoard, with the coins independently valued between any reward normally shared between the landowner and finders.
A school has celebrated a special tree planting that is helping it to spell out its continuing academic success. A mountain ash has been planted at Aylsham High School. It added to trees originally planted in 1957 to spell out Aylsham using the first letter of each species. Up until now, the row spelt only Aylsham, due to the missing M at the end. Duncan Spaulding, executive head teacher at Aylsham High School, said, "How wonderful to reinstate such a fantastic celebration of Aylsham High and of our natural world. Every ring inside these trees represents a new class joining AHS, every fifth ring a whole school career. It is lovely that the word Aylsham will be complete once more, and that a project started almost 70 years ago will get a new lease of life from our current students. Here's to them all growing together. The new addition was made possible thanks to the Tree Council and a student fittingly named Rowan Curtis, as the mountain ash is also known as a Rowan tree." Rowan said, "It's amazing to plant a tree that shares my name. I will enjoy watching it grow while I attend Aylsham High School and for years after." The planting follows recent efforts by Aylsham High School pupils and the Town Council's Climate Emergency Group, which worked to establish more than 800 trees as a hedgerow near the old station yard, funded by the Tree Council's Network Rail Community Tree Planting Programme. Adam Curtis, Senior Officer for Community Planting Projects at the Tree Council, said, "Finally, the tree acronym will actually spell out Aylsham. It's been a long time coming, and the trees planted in 1957 will be a little bit more established than their new neighbour."
A galaxy of starfish is set to light up a North Norfolk church. The 2-metre-wide art installation, titled Asteroidea, will be displayed against the east window of Salthouse Church, marking its return after a 23-year absence. The piece was created in 2003 by artists Margie Britz and Liz McGowan as part of a group exhibition, and was designed to evoke the same wonder people feel when gazing at the night sky. Ms. Britz said, "We took starfish from the bottom of the sea and threw them up into the air as a galaxy. Gazing at the stars inspires a sense of awe, and the artists want viewers to experience that awe in relation to these extraordinary sea creatures, along with their unique chalk reef habitat." The title, Asteroidea, is the scientific term for starfish, derived from the Greek words aster, star, and eidos, like. Starfish are ancient creatures that predate dinosaurs and have survived five mass extinctions. The installation was created using starfish collected from beaches between Holcombe and Weybourne, often stranded by a mix of strong winds and high tides. A programme of events will accompany the exhibition. It begins with a solstice opening event on Sunday, June the 21st, from 8:30 p.m. to 10:30 p.m. At dusk, the storyteller Hugh Lupton will share the story of Orion, accompanied by improvised sound, projection and voice from the group Ether. On Sunday, June the 28th, divers Rob Spray and Dawn Watson will give an illustrated talk on the Norfolk Chalk Reef, exploring the lives of starfish and offering a seaweed pressing activity. For the June the 28th talk, entry is £5 for adults, with children admitted free. Booking is required for most events by emailing margiecbrits@gmail.com. Attendees are encouraged to bring cash for refreshments.
The spectacular sight of thousands of butterflies arriving from across the North Norfolk coast last summer seemed to signal a revival in fortunes for the endangered creatures. While numbers soared after a terrible 2024, a survey has revealed that many species face an uphill struggle for survival in the county. Volunteers in Norfolk walked more than 2,500 kilometres for the National UK Butterfly Monitoring Scheme, UKBMS, last year and counted a total of 85,071 butterflies, a huge increase on the 40,698 counted in 2024 and 53,595 in 2023. Common blue numbers rose by 173% in 2025 compared to the year before, while the migratory clouded yellow was recorded at 16 sites, up from just one, according to the Norfolk branch of National Charity Butterfly Conservation. One of the most spectacular examples of butterflies thriving in last year's warm weather was the arrival of a large number of small whites and large whites from over the North Sea. Several people in June reported thousands coming in across the North Norfolk coast. Small tortoiseshell numbers also improved, but were still very low for what was previously considered a common butterfly. Small blue, which has been recorded in small numbers at Craneych Camp since 2022, also added to the good news picture. The count soared to 65 in the latest UK BMS survey. At Broadland Country Park, 55 silver-studded blues were counted, compared to 15 in 2024. The UK subspecies of swallowtail, which is only found in the Norfolk Broads, had a strong year, with UK BMS count of 166 compared to 88 the previous summer. Other Norfolk priority species, White Admiral, Small Heath, Grayling and Wall, also showed positive progress. Dingy and Grizzled Skipper numbers remain steady, but their future in Norfolk remains fragile. The Butterfly Conservation Norfolk branch has stressed that many local successes have only happened because of years of dedicated conservation work, much of it reliant on volunteers. Branch spokesman Malcolm Fisher said, "Butterflies are so valuable to us in so many ways. For many, They are a way to feel a connection to the natural world. But for ecologists, they are also an invaluable indicator of the health of the whole environment. As pollinators, they provide an essential ecosystem service. At the Norfolk branch, we are always on the lookout for more volunteers to help with surveys, to provide data that enables us to continue to monitor the health of butterfly populations. We provide training, so you don't need to be an expert. You just have to care about our natural world. Alan Dawson, who has served as the charity's Norfolk Transect coordinator for 13 years, said, "One thing that 2025 has taught us is how butterflies can bounce back from adversity given a hot summer. It would be nice to think that the high numbers seen in 2025 are the start of a major revival, but that, of course, depends on a lot of factors. Unfortunately, we are aware many of Norfolk species are still at risk from a volatile climate and loss of habitat. Butterfly Conservation is encouraging people to take part in this year's Big Butterfly Count from July the 17th to August the 9th.
Sheringham Little Theatre is set to perform Jeeves and Wooster in Perfect Nonsense at Beeler Hall. The afternoon of entertainment will take place on July the 26th from 12 p.m. and will include a performance from the Boathouse Blues Band. There will also be a hog roast, street food, bar, and fabulous stalls. The event is in aid of the Friends of Boardswell and Beeler Churches. For more information on tickets, visit ticketsource.co.uk or call 01362 688 499.
The Mayor of Cromer has organised a charity event to raise money for two local organisations. Richard Leeds is behind the event, dubbed Wings and Wishes, to aid East Anglian Children's Hospice and East Anglia Air Ambulance. It is on Monday, May the 4th, at the Sundown Marquee, The Grove, Cromer, and will feature a barbecue, live music, a magician, a raffle, and an auction. The evening, beginning with arrivals from 6:30 p.m. for a 7 p.m. start, is expected to conclude at around 11 p.m. Tickets are available at £36 each, with all proceeds directed towards the two charities. Organisers are urging the local community to support the event through ticket purchases and participation in fundraising activities. Tickets can be booked through Cromer Town Council by phone at 01263 511 2254 or via email at admin@cromer-tc.gov.uk.
An auction is set to support Ethiopia's only hospice as it battles rising costs. St Michael's Community Hall in Reefham is hosting an auction on Saturday, May the 13th at 7 p.m. with all the proceeds going to Hospice Ethiopia. The evening will kick off with a talk by Eddie Anderson, a former Anglia TV presenter, who will share tales from his life in North Norfolk. Auction items include a week's stay in a holiday cottage near Tintagel, meals at the Gunton Arms and the Saracen's Head, and tickets to Hunstanton Sea Life Sanctuary, Sheringham Little Theatre and Pensthorpe. Original artwork, jewellery and more will also be up for grabs. Hospice Ethiopia, serving a nation of over 135 million people, relies entirely on charitable funds from the West. The recent war in the Middle East has driven the price of essential food items to more than double, and fuel shortages have created queues lasting over 4 hours. Tickets are £12 and can be purchased via Eventbrite or by emailing info@hospiceethiopia, that's all one word, .org.uk after May the 9th. For more information, visit hospiceethiopia.org.uk.
More than 250 vehicles took part in a charity run in Sheringham and raised more than £6,000 for a vital life-saving organisation. The annual St George's Day event, which started from Sheringham Car Park, saw classic, unusual and collectible vehicles following a route map through the North Norfolk countryside, ending at Holcombe Hall. The event was in aid of the East Anglian Air Ambulance, EAAA. The North Norfolk Classic Vehicle Club has raised £80,000 for the EAAA from previous runs.
Our last few articles cover something different on the food front: an ice cream dynasty, a birthday party to remember, and a life-changing job opportunity.
A new food trailer offering something different has opened at a seafront location. Kate Carter has launched Fraggies on the Esplanade in Sheringham and is specialising in assi bowls. The sweet treat is a smoothie-like dish made from blended frozen assi fruit and topped with things such as granola, fresh fruit and nut spread. Assi bowls are really popular abroad and in cities in the UK, but there's nothing like that in Sheringham, Miss Carter said. So it has been great to bring something different to Sheringham, and I already have some regulars. The menu includes Fraggie's signature bowl, made up of assi sorbet base, topped with granola, strawberries, banana, peanut butter, coconut flakes and cacao nibs. People can also make their own with toppings of their choice. As well as assi bowls, the trailer offers a range of canned drinks, coffees and matchas. I would not have been able to do this without the support of my parents, Miss Carter explained. Since opening, I have had an amazing response from locals. I have honestly been shocked at how supportive and positive people have been. People have been loving the bowls. The trailer is open from 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. every week, from Tuesdays to Sunday, though Miss Carter is hoping to make stops at businesses around the county while she gets established. Later this month, she is collaborating with the Goat Shed at Honingham and is planning an event with Apollo Health Clinic in Sheringham. I am teaming up with as many local businesses as possible, she added. They have all been so great to me. Easter weekend was so busy, and I'm really looking forward to the summer.
It was a family-run business that became well known for its ice cream dynasty in Great Yarmouth. But now, after a 15-year hiatus, the Verdersey legacy has been revived more than 34 miles away in Norfolk's poshest town. Verdersey has opened the doors of its new premises in Bull Street, Holt, offering homemade ice cream, sundaes and coffees in time for the summer season. And for the owners, Joseph Verdersey and his daughter Roberta Rossi, this is more than just setting up a new shop, but rather about continuing their family's dynasty. Mr. Vertesi's grandfather, also called Joseph, established the business originally in Scotland in 1919, but moved to Great Yarmouth and opened the first store in the 1930s. From ice cream parlours to Italian restaurants and gift shops, the family ran 15 stores in the town over the 20th century, becoming a major employer in the area. But after they stopped trading at a market stall 15 years ago, the business ceased to continue in Great Yarmouth. Now the pair hope to rebuild the name once again, while paying homage to the legacy it carried before them. Mrs. Rossi said, "The family was so well known, everyone knew the Vitesses, and it is about getting that back. The shop will focus on traditional ice cream, which is made in the same batch freezer that his grandfather used in 1919. While it will not offer different flavours of ice cream, it will offer homemade raspberry and chocolate sauces alongside toppers such as a flake or sprinkles. People have lost the plot with ice cream, so we've gone back to basics," Mr. Vitesse said. "You can't let the ice cream die. The Vitesse family originate from the Italian village of Valvore, which is close to the cities of Rome and Naples."
You could say it was the ultimate way to bridge a generational gap. It was certainly a case of the young meeting the old at one Norfolk care home when two birthdays were celebrated on the same day. Wilmot Ching marked his 100th birthday at Aylsham Residential Manor House, surrounded by his family. At the same time, he met his one-year-old great-grandson, Franklin, for the first time as he was brought over from Denmark to Aylsham to celebrate their big day. Mr. Ching described it as very special as he watched the youngster wander around the room and play with his 100th birthday badge while their loved ones gathered around them both. The day also held an extra sentiment for the family, as it was celebrated at the care home which Mr. Ching and his wife Valeria had founded together in 1981. They bought the Grade II listed building in a dilapidated state, but room by room they brought it back to life. The home quickly became a part of the family, with all five of their children, Denise Dennis, Nikki Fisher, Christopher Ching, Nigel Ching, and Tom Ching, involved in different ways. Mr. Ching and his daughters recounted some of his favourite memories over the years, including travelling across Africa and India after the Second World War and running a farm in Wales. When he asked what his secret was, he said his family kept him young. Mrs. Fisher said he was a philanthropist and was always looking for ways to improve other lives. Ms. Dennis added, "He was always ready to take on a challenge and never frightened to move on. He always made life fun for us all." After the first round of celebrations was held at the care home, the group moved to Marsham Village Hall, where more family members were waiting to mark the special day.
A former volunteer has described how she landed a life-changing role as cafe manager just months after starting on the team. Morgan Rose Neary began volunteering at the East Anglia's Children's Hospices Each charity shop in Hoveton last July while unemployed. Due to staff shortages, she increased her hours and soon became a regular fixture at Cafe 98, the coffee shop within the Station Road premises. Ms. Neary said, "I wanted a job and to be independent, but was having interviews without getting anywhere or feeling I was making any progress. That's when it was suggested volunteering would be a good idea for me, to meet new people and get some experience under my belt." In October, she was offered the role of cafe manager. Ms. Neary said, "I loved volunteering here, and when an opening to be cafe manager presented itself, I was asked if I'd consider applying. The best I'd been hoping for at that time was a low-level job that would pay the bills. Instead, I was offered this golden opportunity at a place so close to my heart. I jumped at the opportunity, and the last few months have been among the best of my life." Hoveton is her home, and she said being part of the community gives her work special meaning. Ms. Neary said, I know the people here and I love the community spirit. I also love meeting new customers. It's amazing how many interesting people walk through our door with a story to tell. Her story is being shared as part of a volunteer recruitment campaign to support Each's work with families across the region. Cafe 98 is named in recognition of the year Quiddenham Children's Hospice and Milton Children's Hospice merged to form Each. To learn more about volunteering at the shop or cafe, visit in person or call 01603 369 852.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of The Mardler, with readings from the North Norfolk News. If you have any comments or queries, you can contact our listener liaison officer, Imogen Waterson, on 01263 587 610.
Perhaps we should just mention that if you have a smartphone, tablet or computer, or know someone who has, you can listen to this and other editions online at mardler.org.uk. You can also use an Alexa smart speaker, a variety of smartphone apps, or even a telephone call to listen. Find out the details on our website, mardler.org.uk.
We rely on receiving your returned memory sticks and pouches so that we can continue to send you new editions each week. So please remember to return the pouch and memory stick promptly, making sure to reverse the address label first.
The sound engineer today was Richard Wilson. Editing and producing this issue were Chris and Lorna Wilson. But do keep listening, as immediately following this edition of The Mardler, you can hear items from the Talking News Federation. Our colleagues in the copying and dispatch room join us in wishing you the best of health. And we look forward to joining you in a week's time. But for now it's...
Cheerio!
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Scientific advances offer hope for patients with sight loss. In summary, doctors have discovered new ways to treat low eye pressure and dry macular degeneration. Trials of both treatments have delivered sight improvements for patients and brought hope that more people could benefit as the new discoveries are rolled out more widely. This article is written by Heather and read by Vivian. Two recent trials have discovered new ways of treating eye conditions, and both offer potential for wider application to help more people suffering from sight loss. In one breakthrough, doctors at Moorfields Eye Hospital in London discovered that a low-cost gel could restore vision for patients with hypotony, an unusual but dangerous condition caused by low pressure in the eyeball. Meanwhile, in California, the inventors of a tiny microchip were looking for volunteers with advanced age-related dry macular degeneration to sign up for trials to help them read again. Some 32 patients joined the trial, including 5 in the UK, to have a microchip implanted behind one retina with a wireless link to video glasses. First, let's find out more about the gel treatment. Moorfields Hospital in London is home to a dedicated clinic for people with hypotony. This is a condition where the pressure in the eyeball becomes too low and the eye can start to collapse. The low pressure is caused by a lack of the natural jelly-like fluid inside the eye. This deficit can be caused by a range of factors. For example, an infection, a reaction to medication, or an after effect of eye surgery. It's a serious problem as it can lead to blindness. Until this trial, the standard treatment for hypotony used steroids and silicone oil to plump up the eye. However, there were problems. For example, the silicone oil could be difficult to see through. The treatment didn't restore much vision, and the substances used could be toxic if used long term. Looking for an alternative, the Moorfields doctors decided to try an alternative treatment using a low-cost, transparent, water-based gel. The gel, known as HPMC or hydroxypropyl methylcellulose, was already used in some types of eye surgery. But rather than using it as a one-off, the Moorfields team decided to inject it into the main part of the eye as a new regular treatment. Gel was injected every 3 to 4 weeks for a total of 10 months, with remarkable results, increasing the size and pressure of the eyes and restoring sight. 7 of the 8 patients who received the treatment experienced improvements in vision and eye pressure after a 12-month course of the treatment. Moorfields consultant Harry Petrushkin, who led the work, said, "We are excited that this simple treatment has proved so effective for patients with this rare condition. This is the start of a process of understanding more about the balance of fluid inside the eye, leading to improved care for our patients. There are now hopes that the treatment can be made more widely available, although there is still more work to do to work out which patients can benefit. And now let's turn to the high-tech implants being tested on patients with dry age-related macular degeneration. People with age-related macular degeneration typically suffer from blurred or distorted central vision, making it difficult to read or to see details. However, they often retain some photoreceptor cells and retinal neurons in their optic nerve that can pass visual information to the brain, allowing some peripheral vision. Aiming to help improve sight for people living with this problem, scientist Daniel Palanca from Stanford University in California collaborated with colleagues to develop a microchip called Prima. Prima is a tiny 2mm square solar-powered wireless microchip that is only the thickness of a human hair. The chip is implanted in the back of the patient's eye and, once in place, it can receive images via an infrared transfer and send those images along the optic nerve to the patient's brain. It's a complicated multi-stage process as the images need to be captured and processed before they can be sent to the brain. In simple terms, it works like this. The images are first of all captured by a small camera mounted on a pair of glasses. All images are captured in black and white. The camera sends an infrared beam of the images to the implanted Prima chip. The Prima chip sends the images back to the small pocket-sized processor, which enhances the images to make them clearer. And finally, the enhanced images are sent back to the brain via the Prima chip and the optic nerve, allowing the patient to see the images. The results of the trial so far are impressive. After a year, 27 of the 32 patients given the implant were able to read again using their central vision. The glasses allowed them to magnify what they were seeing by up to 12 times and to adjust the brightness and contrast. At the moment, Prima only uses black and white images, but the developers hope a colour version may be possible in future. While restoring the ability to read is life-changing for the patients involved in the trial, it is fair to say that getting used to Prima came with some challenges. About 2/3 of the volunteers experienced short-term side effects following implants, including high pressure in the eye, although this didn't prevent vision improvements. The other challenge was learning how to use the combination of Prima, glasses and pocket processor, which took several months. In the UK, Sheila, age 70, was one of the patients who signed up for Prima trials at Moorfields Eye Hospital. She said that learning to read using the system needed huge concentration, but she's delighted with the results. She only uses the system indoors because she needs to hold her head very still and apply great concentration to be able to read. Sometimes she needs to put a pillow under her chin to steady her head so that she can focus on the letters of the word she's trying to read. Mahi Mukwit is a consultant surgeon at Moorfields who led the UK arm of the trial. He said the Prima system was the first implant to give patients meaningful vision that they can use in their daily life, such as reading and writing. Prima is not yet licensed, so it's not available outside clinical trials. But let's hope that the results of the trials mean it could be made more widely available in the future.
Hello, Roger here with another quiz. 10 questions, thinking caps on, and away we go. Question 1, half a point each for these. How old are Prince William and Kate? How old is Prince William and how old is Kate? Question 2. Who was Lord Haw Haw? Question 3. Joe Biden was the second Catholic president of the United States. Who was the first? Question 4. Who was the first winner of the popular TV series Strictly Come Dancing? He was already well known for something else at the time. Question 5. Who was the second official James Bond? So we're not counting David Niven in a fly-off version of Casino Royale. We're talking about the mainstream James Bonds. The first, of course, was Sean Connery. Who was the second? Question 6. Who succeeded Winston Churchill as Prime Minister of the United Kingdom after the end of the war, 1945? Question 7. Which Saint's Day do we commemorate on December the 26th? December the 26th. Question 8. In which ocean is Christmas Island located? Christmas Island, where it received the bomb tests, atomic bomb tests. Question 9. What are the opening words of the song Winter Wonderland? And finally, question 10. When was the charity single Do They Know It's Christmas first released? It was in Christmas in 19... something. There we go. Hello, Roger back again with the answers to our general knowledge quiz. Question 1 was how old are Prince William and Princess Kate, the royals? And the answer to that is they're both 43, although Kate is marginally the elder of the two of them by a few months. Question 2, who was Lord Haw Haw? Well, Lord Haw Haw was the mocking name given to him by the Brits for William Joyce, who was a traitor of the First Order, broadcasting Germany Calling and spouting destabilising rubbish on behalf of the Germans during World War II. Question 3. If Joe Biden was the second Catholic president of the United States, who was the first? Well, that was John F. Kennedy. Question 4. The first winner of Strictly Come Dancing was newsreader Natasha Kaplinsky. Natasha Kaplinsky. who moved on in life and is now, at the time of this recording, the head of the British Board of Film Censors, or whatever its current name is. Question 5. Who was the second official James Bond, who was also the shortest-lived? And that was George Lazenby. George Lazenby. Question 6. Who succeeded Winston Churchill as Prime Minister of the UK in 1945? That was Clement Attlee. Clem Attlee. Question 7. Which Saint's Day did we celebrate on December the 26th? That was Saint Stephen. Question 8. On which ocean is Christmas Island? It is in the Indian Ocean. The opening words, number 9, opening words of Winter Wonderland are sleigh bells ring. Sleigh bells ring. Are you listening? Etc. And question 10, another Christmassy themed one. When did the recording of Do They Know It's Christmas first get released? And that was Christmas 1984. 10 questions, which you either got a full mark for 9 of, or maybe half, with Prince William being 43 and Kate also being 43. So they were half each. Thank you for listening. Bye.
Hello, it's Clive Davis from the Wildlife Sound Recording Society. In November of 2025, I visited the North Norfolk coast, the intention being to go to Titchwell RSPB Reserve. Up to 40,000, maybe 50,000, pink-footed geese travel to the North Norfolk coast. As I parked on the car park, I could hear the sound of a muntjac deer calling. It was close to my vehicle, and I thought that as soon as I opened the door, it would move. However, it continued to call, and I was able to get some recording kit set up at the back of my van. You may hear the occasional sound of somebody's voice as they walk across the car park to their vehicles. I realised that there was more than one muntjac, and that was probably why it did not move, as it was calling to the other males in the area. There are only 2 indigenous deer in the UK, the red and the roe. Muntjac deer were introduced into Woburn Park in Bedfordshire in the late 19th, early 20th century and escaped from there and rapidly establishing feral populations throughout the UK. They are also known as the barking deer, which is quite obvious from the calls that I recorded. RSPB Titchwell is a great reserve. From the car park, you walk through a small woodland area, past the RSPB buildings, and onto a long straight footpath. This leads past some lakes to your right-hand side, eventually ending up on the beach. It's about a kilometre in length. This is a recording of some Brent geese, a small goose that migrates into the UK in winter. They had landed on one of the lakes and were washing the salt water from their wings and their bodies before moving into the marsh, either to roost or to feed during the evening period. There are also some pinkfoot in the area, and you can hear those occasionally in the background. The following day, I went on the search for pinkfoot geese. Between 40 and 50,000 pinkfoot geese migrate into the UK every year, coming from Iceland, Svalbard and the Greenland areas. In Norfolk, the farmers leave the tops of the sugar beet, once it's been cropped, for the pinkfoot geese to feed on. And behind Titchwell, in the farmers' fields, there can be large flocks that sometimes congregate. So I went in search and found probably 1,000 pinkfoot geese sitting in a large field. They were vocal, but it was quite subdued. However, I set up some recording kit behind a hedge and just stood there watching them. As I did so, I suddenly realised that the vocalisations had increased, and as I turned around, I saw massive flocks of pinkfoot geese flying across the fields, coming into land. It was an amazing sight. There was three, maybe four, large flocks, and the sound became really intense as they flew over me and then landed in the field. Ha ha ha! I do hope that you enjoyed those recordings.
TNS Soundings.